defenses are exceptions to the rules, and if you have.
Okay. Hello, today is April Fool's Day, 2015. I'm opening the House hearing, the House session on the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And I'm going to open a public hearing on 2959. Alvin, can we please hear about the bill?
Certainly. My apologies. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2959 directs Housing and Community Services to disperse funds from specified housing accounts to be dedicated to benefit the county from which fees were collected, declares emergency effective on passage.
Madam Chair, honorable committee members, for the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, House Representative of State Representative, House District 53. Madam Chair, if you remember, we sat over there, I think, last session. And
I remember that fondly.
I lived in this committee room from 8 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock at night, 3 days a week. So I bring you a good bill today. Thank you for hearing it. It does relate to use of fees charged by counties for certain housing programs. House Bill 2959 requires Housing and Community Services Department to dedicate and use portions of monies deposited in certain housing accounts from the County Assessment and Taxation Fund for the benefit of the county from which the fees deposited into the fund were charged and collected. Madam Chair, I'm the only representative in this room, and as a Republican, too, who voted for the $15 document fee addition and the $5 document fee. The 15 was in 2009. The $5 document fee, I believe, was 2013. Senator Knope and Representative Bueller and I, during the interim, or during the summer, we were asked several times by our county, Deschutes County housing advocates, where's the beef? Where's the money for our housing needs? Deschutes County is the largest growth county. Bend has one of the tightest housing markets, particularly for our workforce. We currently have a rental vacancy rate of less than 1%. It's 0.5%. I've looked at the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department data, including Deschutes County, about the document fee money. I think the data indicates that Deschutes County, and I guess you're going to receive information later from the director, has collected over $4 million since the inception of the recording fees. $4 million is roughly 40% of the statewide collection, but our county is only 4% of the state population. And we've only received $700,000 in funding for this investment. We gave $4 million, we've gotten $700,000 back. This is unacceptable. Senator Knope and I, with Representative Bueller, we've introduced the same bill in the Senate House. Senate bill was 516, and we're hearing today House Bill 2959. That's why we wanted to be sure that we got something back to Deschutes County. We have a problem, I'm telling you, we have a problem, a housing problem, okay? And we put this bill, this body passed these bills to help us provide additional housing in our county, our counties. I was told that the housing department does not return the funds to the counties based upon the need, the need that they determine, not based upon where the money came from. And I'm going to go back and read the original bill to see what we put in that original bill back in 2009. But there's no higher housing and shelter needs than Deschutes County. Madam Chair, I'm stating for the record, I'm willing to work with the housing department to develop some transparency in the process. But that process must give extra weights based upon the county's contribution. We want to help our brothers and sisters. But when we give $4 million and only get $700,000, well, that's bad investment, a return on your investment. Again, the current process is unacceptable and not what I thought I was voting for. But in closing, Madam Chair, I kindly request you allow us to work with housing to see if we can get an amendment to satisfy our concerns and take care of what they think they can do and how the process works. Or pass the bill. We gave $4 million for housing. We got $700,000. We need it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and esteemed members of the committee. For the record, my name is Newt Buehler. I'm representative in House District 54, which is most of Bend. And I want to underline some of the points that my senior colleague from Central Oregon has made.
Way senior.
Young man. More gray hair also, I should mention. But we have a serious problem with regards to affordable housing, in not just Bend, but Central Oregon. Vacancy rates now have dropped below 0.5. Actually, the latest figures is 0.25%. Essentially, there is no housing available. This is such an issue that the biggest problem at our homeless shelter, Bethlehem Inn, now is a lack of parking, because it's not the typical homeless that you're seeing. You're seeing families that have lost their apartment for whatever reason, because it's been sold or remodeled, and there's simply nowhere to go when they leave the apartment. This is a huge problem for us. And it was supposed to be helped by the legislation that Representative was involved with in 2009, which would allow the document recording fees that were generated to go back to affordable housing. Unfortunately, a relatively small percentage of the money has come back to Central Oregon, correlated with a large percentage that has gone out of the area. We think this is basically unfair, considering that we have such a problem with regards to this issue. House Bill 2959 would ensure that 75% of the money would come back to the county of origin. The other 25% spread around the state based on whatever criteria is developed. That's another problem with the current system. It's not transparent on what categories, what criteria this money is being allocated across the state, and I think that needs to be brought to light, and hopefully testimony later today by Director Van Fleet will clear up that. In addition, as we've looked into this issue, as concerning is that there's been approximately $60 million generated from this piece of legislation since 2009. And $20 million, and perhaps more, is still sitting in accounts not being used for affordable housing. I would like to understand why that is and how we can solve that problem. So basically, this bill really adds accountability to the process. We want to know how the money is being distributed across the state. It adds fairness or equity, sending a large portion, or at least 75% of those funds, back to the county of origin, and hopefully efficiency in terms of trying to get this money out into the communities where it was designed to be, to enhance affordable housing across Oregon. And this is especially acute problem when the budget for affordable housing is proposed to go up substantially, along with $100 million in bonding capacity. If there's already $20 million not being spent, are we allocating this money appropriately? I think affordable housing is an issue we have to take seriously, and we have to do so much better, and I think this is just one way to further that goal. So thank you very much, and thank you for your time.
Great, thank you. Questions from the committee?
I have a question. I've been reading a lot about all the shortage of housing across the state, and it really does, Bend does seem to have it pretty much worse than anywhere else. Obviously, we have problems across the whole state, like I said. What is the estimated need? I mean, if folks could really have their way, do you have any idea how many units approximately?
Well, first of all, realize, I live in Sun River, and everyone says, oh, you live in Sun River. There's no housing shortage, Madam Chair, Representative. The workforce in Sun River and in Bend, Oregon, is people that want to come and have, they're beginning their careers or whatever. So we have a lot of low income. Most of our schools are Title I, Title III, and child or lunch supported and the whole thing. So that's the need. It's that low, and we're still working on our urban growth plan for Bend. They've had some issues. So it's supply and demand. And right now, because you can't the housing, they can't afford to buy a house, they're looking for rental property or lower income, and it's really a bar. I worked on, as you know, the Commission for Children and Families, and we got a big demand. We have some housing, and we built some housing, but it's not enough. And Representative Buehler talked about Bethlehem Inn. It's a great facility. It's an old motel that they're going to buy. The county bought it, and the nonprofit Bethlehem Inn is now buying that. It started out as a program. Churches were opening up the church during the winter months to people to sleep in a warm place and get a meal. And they got a great program there. They bought this motel. They're going to update it. But as also as the representative said, they sometimes sleep in their car in the parking lot because there's not a lot of family rooms available. So we do. It's a big, it's strange. You know, it's not a lot of retirees, a lot of senior people. They come there to retire, so that drives up the cost of housing. And just we try real hard. We have a lot of good nonprofits trying to take care of that need. But, you know, if you can build a house for $500,000 on a property or whatever, $1 million versus it, they're going to go for the bigger dollars, things like that. The city's working on affordable housing locations and things, but we're behind it. The growth is so fast, too.
Madam Chair and Representative Taylor, if I may, the demand is hard to measure because we're missing a lot of opportunities. There's recently been a out-of-state manufacturing business that's wanted to move to Bend after a short visit. They said, you know, we like your community, we like the opportunity here, but it's pretty simple. Our people would not have anywhere to live. We have to skip over this community. So it's hurting us in a lot of ways, and I think it's hard to measure those missed opportunities right now.
Madam Chair, you know, like Sun River, they looked at doing the Whistler. If everyone's ever been to Whistler, where they have housing up above, we looked. One company came in and tried to look into doing that, but majority of the employees that work at the resort, one of the largest employers in the county, their employee base works outside or lives outside of Sun River, and a lot of low-cost housing and manufacturing homes and things like that.
Okay. Thank you for bringing this to our attention.
Thank you very much.
At one point, I had talked to some of you about jumping back to the lottery and then trying to end with this, but we only have three people signed up for this, and Representative Kennemer has agreed to come later on the lottery bill. So I think we're going to go with the flow and continue on this bill. Margaret Van Fleet, please. Just her, right? Yep, you're good. Thank you.
Questions. Yeah. We were ready for some April Fool's questions.
Okay, thank you. April Fool's is rearranging the agenda. Yes. Jokes on me. And me.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Housing and Community Services Department. Today I want to talk you through the status of the document recording fee. You've heard the concerns. I share the concerns. So I'm going to do my best today to walk you through the status, what's outstanding, what's still unspent, and kind of what our plan is to get those dollars deployed in communities. And then obviously happy to answer any questions. So by way of quick background, the document recording fee was created back in 2009, as you heard. It's divided into three primary uses, with the biggest of those being what we call the general housing account. And that's the place where the multifamily finance dollars go. The emergency housing account is for shelter and homeless assistance programs. And then you can see that 14% is dedicated to homeownership related activities. Since inception, we have received $58 million. So this slide shows you, against those three accounts, how much has been received and what has been expended. Now, the biggest number there, as you can see, is in the multifamily area. There's a couple of pieces behind that I want to explain. About $5 million of that $20 million in the GHAP is reserved for projects that have come through our process, and they're not under construction yet or they haven't closed. There's another $3 million inside of that we are accumulating for veterans NOFA offering. But clearly, that leaves a lot that is yet to be expended. I would say to you that I think our agency hasn't been as aggressive as we could be, and I have a plan to correct that, and I'll be able to walk you through that plan today. Another question that has come up here is around administration. You can see here the percentages as they exist so far. Those are measured against how much has been expended. So as we accelerate expenditures under the multifamily program or the GHAP program, I expect that 10% number to go down. I think the other two can also come down, but I think it's too early for me to sort of promise a percentage. We did look this up. There was not a defined administrative expense articulated in the statute, but it's something I'm keeping an eye on.
Do you have a goal?
I don't, actually, Madam Chair, but let me think about that. So I want to take a couple of minutes and walk you through each of these accounts and tell you how it works and how we get the money out the door. So again, the majority, 76% of this funding goes into the various multifamily finance programs that we administer. It is blended, because this is the typical way that affordable multifamily finance is done. It's blended with a variety of other sources and leverages also private financing. You've heard from myself and others that this building and developing and financing this housing is terribly complex, and there's all these layers of financing, and this is one of the places where that comes into play. Now, we use a competition because we have to. That's driven mostly by the federal programs, but it's also required by these other state resources because there's more need than we can satisfy. And so we use competitive processes that we call NOFAs, or Notices of Funds Availability. And in 2015, we have seven separate NOFAs planned. Very traditionally have all kinds of developers, be they community-based nonprofits, local housing authorities, or private for-profit developers, take advantage of these opportunities. A couple of the funding sources that get blended here, and I've got a little bit more detail on these in a slide or two. The most complicated, but frankly the most substantial resource, is the federal tax credit. We also get certain grant streams from HUD that are designed for housing development. On the state level, we have the document recording fee, of course, but a number of other state-generated resources. And this mixing and matching involves all of these sources of funds. So in recent years, we have worked to improve the competition and the way it is that we hold that, what we require, and how we score and rate and rank the projects that come to us. We package different sources of funds to the best of our knowledge and based on some of our stakeholder feedback to do different types of projects so that small projects don't have to compete against large projects. And so, for example, we have one NOFA on the street that uses primarily federal tax credits, and that's best suited for large projects. Sometimes those also blend other kinds of state tax credits and other grants, and so we package those in ways that we believe meets the need, and then we ask people to tell us how they would use that blending of funds to develop properties. We also have a separate NOFA just for preservation, and you've heard a little bit about the importance of preserving existing properties, especially those with federal rent subsidies attached to them. We will have particular NOFAs for housing for veterans. Mobile home park preservation is a particular need and niche in our field, and so on and so forth. In recent years, as I say, we have worked to focus more particularly on need for individual projects and community impact. And this has been a big shift for us as a department and also for our sponsors to be able to articulate need and weigh and measure one needy project, one worthy project against another. It's much more of an art than a science, I would say. We have begun using external scoring committees with oversight by the Oregon State Housing Council, soon to be the Housing Stability Council. We think that helps and will continue to help drive us towards greater transparency, accountability, and oversight. One of the things we've tried to do in response to community concerns is establish geographic targets based on sort of the proportion of low-income population and severe rent burden. We're also trying to work more closely and collaboratively with our local partners, be those through regional solutions or early learning hubs, or just a local planning body that has prioritized housing. We want to balance that role of the state being sort of the decider of what's most important with recognizing that regional collaboratives are really a powerful tool, and so we want to make room for understanding those perspectives in our process. Another quick word about the external scoring committee. I think this is a piece where we can continue to drive some of this transparency and making sure that it's not just our eyes that are, you know, sort of thinking about need and selecting the winners and losers. In the last couple of years, we've been fortunate to have folks look at these questions of capacity, financial viability, some of the data measures. We have them help us look at need and impact and different kinds of preferences. So far, we've been lucky to have folks who are really a diverse group of experts in housing finance. We've had two former HUD staffers, retired HUD staffers, who've had time to volunteer for this effort for us. Bankers, regional solutions folks out of the governor's office, local foundation officers, and a couple of local jurisdictions. So we've tried to get folks who are sort of not conflicted and are knowledgeable and, again, can help us weigh and measure, so it's not just state officials scoring and picking the winners. One of the things that has been important, and I think we can continue to refine this, and I think this would very much get to the concerns of my friends in Central Oregon, around how should we be thinking about need. There are lots of ways to look at data that demonstrates need. There's things like vacancy rates. There's things like rent levels and the gap between rents and wages. There's ways to think about rent burden, and you've heard me talk about rent burden and severely rent burdened folks. And so these are some of the pieces that we're currently asking our sponsors and our applicants to look at. And I think, again, this is a place where we can hone our focus and do a better job of making sure that we prioritize places like Bend, where they have clearly an extreme housing problem. I wanted to show you the volume of dollars that we're talking about for 2015. Again, we mix and match these. I won't go through these in detail, but you can see they tend to be pretty complicated, and this is part of the story about why it's hard to get it all out the door. But I think we're in a place where we have a good system for doing that. Now, the $90 million that we're putting on the street this year, I should say, represents a bit of a bubble, and that's partly because of the General Housing Account Program or the document recording fee. It's higher this year than it has been. And to some degree, we are all, in addition to playing catch-up, we are also going to be more thoughtfully forward allocating. Traditionally, the department waited until it had all the money in hand, then offered it, and then it would take a year or even two for a project to get through the construction process. And so what we're trying to do is really pivot to forward allocating based on a reasonable projection of what's going to come in the door. I think this will also help.
So is this a bubble in part because you had pent up reserves and in part because you have an unusually high recording fee activity?
There has, Madam Chair, it's both, but it is more the fact that we've had a bubble. Certainly the incremental fee income from the veterans, the addition of the veterans since 2013 is a piece of that. But I want to say that in these figures, that's only about $3 million. So, yeah, that's... And then there's some other sort of complicating factors, which I won't take time for, but I think you get the point is there's a lot of money. We see the need. We're eager to get it out on the street and make sure it's deployed well. Wanted to show you just a kind of a quick view of projects that have been funded by this account, this document recording fee, just in the last 5 years. About 2,500 units in 66 projects covering 22 counties. And that in all cases, that leveraged other sources of funds, and I'll show you that slide in a minute. Here's the by-county awards out of the General Housing Account Program. Now, this isn't all of it. So this is where Deschutes County's $700,000 comes in. They also did get some small amounts for home ownership and homeless services, but the bulk of it certainly is here. And then this slide and the next one are a look at all of our multifamily financing sources and where have they gone over the last 5 years. It's a lot of production. It's close to 8,000 units in over 200 projects in 31 of our 36 counties. And the dollar amounts there are also pretty significant. So there is a lot of activity happening. And the other piece I would emphasize, you've heard me say this before, for every project we fund, there are, you know, two others or even three in some years that we cannot fund because the primary source of funding for most of these is the federal tax credit, and that's in much shorter supply.
Can I ask a question back there? Mm-hmm. On Wheeler, Lake, Sherman, and Harney, and Coos, who had zero.
Yeah, I'm on the
Do you have any idea what the recording fees were that came from those areas?
I don't have that here, but certainly we've got all of that data. I'd be happy to follow up with the committee. I'm not sure how these two are different, but I will. I guess they're not. Oh, on a per capita basis, that's what it is. This slide shows on a per capita basis for all funding sources how much each county got. I know the committee's short on time, so I'm going to try and expedite here. And then here's a five-year look back of resources that have gone out. The leverage of private sector equity in particular, but also mortgage debt, is pretty substantial with this work. A piece of it, as you know, is dedicated to veterans on the multifamily side. With this account, we have not yet offered these funds. We have a NOFA ready to go out the door in May. We have worked with stakeholders and veteran service providers to help us think about how to package this, and this is what they advised us to do. And so we're going to see what we get in the door when we offer these funds. So the second, moving away from multifamily, the second account is the emergency housing account. That's where 10% of the resources go. These resources go out through our Community Action Agency network by formula, and there's a Community Action Agency, I think you know, that serves every all of our counties in Oregon. For this part of the account, you can see here geographically where those funds have gone. Most of it through the community action agencies. There's something known as the Rural Oregon Continuum of Care, which got a very small amount. And then there's a couple of other statewide nonprofits that also received some funding out of this bucket. And again, for veterans, the community action agencies have already started receiving their allocation against this account. They're working hard with local county veteran services officers and really trying to make sure they use those local networks to connect veterans to the services they need in addition to housing. And then finally, on the homeownership side, this is where 14% goes. This goes out to housing centers and is used for a variety of homeownership-related purposes, including down payment assistance, pre-purchase counseling, education, and so forth. We recently did a NOFA and are about to make awards for homeownership innovation, which will include attempts to close the minority homeownership gap, allowing seniors to age in place, and a couple of other innovations that we've asked folks to come forward with. This is a kind of an hard to see graphic here, but I think the point is just to see geographically, because we want to pay attention to geographically how is this money being spent across the state. And I guess one dot equals $2,000, so I'm not sure how that relates to the what the correlation there is to the homeownership centers, but that data is available. And then on the veteran side, we've been partnering with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to really make sure that we pair our this resources with their vet loan program to do down payment assistance, home repair. We're just about ready to go live with some work with our friends across the street. So all in, this map shows you sort of by gradation where the different resources have gone. And it's a little hard to see, but I think you can see that the population centers certainly have gotten a bit more. There's this Northeast Oregon anomaly, and I'm not quite sure. There's a story behind that, but I don't know what that is. And then this one, I think, is of particular interest because it compares the total doc recording fee that we've expended compared to the population in the state and then the receipts that we've gotten from those different geographies. So this certainly makes the point that Representative Buell and Representative Wisnett were making about that Central is not receiving its fair share, if you will. And I think you can see it's uneven for a variety of reasons across the different regions of the state. I guess what I would say to you is that, I think that's the last slide, that we recognize this problem. We recognize the severity of the concern. I take it, you know, very, very seriously and have had a chance to speak with Representatives Wisnett and Buehler about what our plans are to correct the problems, both on just the getting the money out the door, but also really the transparency. And we haven't done as good a job on the transparency either. I think we're well equipped to do that going forward. I think the Housing Council and the Housing Stability Council that it will become shortly are really poised to do that well. We've been briefing them. And so I'm eager to kind of continue forward and make sure that we can really address this. And I'd be happy to come back at any time and tell you how that's going. I think I'll close there.
Questions? Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. I have actually a question for both Margaret and for Rep. Buehler. Margaret, just out of, in your opinion, if, you know, this bill 2959 were to pass, your competitive process that you had laid out there, would that still work in the sense of being able to use that just based off of specific counties for the 75% that would be allotted to those? Would you still be able to use that process effectively?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Stark, yes and no. I think in places where there's enough fee generated and the based on activity, I could imagine a system where you could match the federal tax credit, for example, with the document recording fee that's coming from that county and be able to put together a project. But I think it's going to be uneven, and I think you're going to find small counties have to wait to accumulate enough. And I think it also doesn't recognize that you know, over time, we would hope it would even out. But year to year, if we're dependent on just, you know, allocating a tax credit based on how much of this particular color of money is coming in from, a county, I think it would be a challenge. We do have a development partner here, I think, who's signed up to testify, who may be able to speak to kind of her perspective about how that would look. I think it would create some challenges.
Yeah. Question for Rep. Buehler. I'm looking at her slide of slide 12, where there's several counties that, from 2010 to 2014, did not have allotments, you know, or projects there. I'm not in one of the things that to my understanding, has been expressed that there's an issue is that money sometimes builds up and is not getting out there. And I would be concerned if there was, you know, some of these counties that aren't receiving money right now, if they have no plans, that money would just keep sitting up and pooling there. Do you see, is there some sort of a hybrid that you could think of where there could be a first priority for the counties for the amount of money that they've put in, but if that money after a year or two or whatever has, there's no, you know, applications for it, that would go into the general pool and be available so that money could consistently be used?
Yeah. Representative Stark, I think that's a great suggestion. It makes a lot of sense, and I'd certainly be willing to work on an amendment to facilitate that. I think that's a good insight. And to speak to your question to Margaret, too, remember there's 20, we're not trying to be hogs here and take all the money come from the county. We're only saying 75%, 25% would go back into to try to equalize among other counties. Certainly we're sensitive to the small counties and their need, too. So I think those are kind of fine-tuning that we could do. I think the main thing is that it needs to be more equitably distributed across the state, and everyone needs to understand the process and the criteria, and I think that's been lacking a little bit.
Any other questions for Margaret? Yes.
Thank you, Chair Kindergart. Margaret, are you confident that you have the processes and personnel in place that can distribute effectively and judiciously the large increase in funds going to affordable housing in this next biennium?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Buehler, I am, and I appreciate the question and I understand the reason for it. And what I would say is I think that we have enough checks and balances and we can watch it through time, and if it's not working, I will be the first to say something's not working, we need to somehow course correct. I do think the Housing Stability Council is a good check on that for us. They meet monthly and they're very used to sort of looking at this level of activity on the multifamily development side. So I my answer is yes, but I understand why there's a question there.
And a quick follow-up. So yes. Why hasn't, help me with why that process hasn't worked with regards to the $20 million now that is sitting in the accounts?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Buehler, I think there's a variety of pieces at play. Our agency has been in transition, and that has been one of the complications. I think it is also fair to say that we haven't internally had good access to information for a variety of reasons. Organizationally, that's been a struggle. I would say to you, and I've shared with Chair Kenny Geyer, we finally have the systems in place where we're talking to, we can see clearly what the data is around how much is out the door and how much is sitting in the bank, so to speak. And that is new, and it's not, it should have been there in the past, and it just wasn't. So I think those are two pieces. And then the third piece is this idea that there was a practice, which I think was put in place in good faith early on when the doc recording fee came to us. We weren't clear how that was going to work, and so we'll sit on it and accumulate it and then offer it up. And so when it came to light that that was what the staff was doing, we said, no, we got to get ahead of this. And so, you know, there's a variety, I've lots of answers to that question. There's no one single reason behind it, but I do feel like my team and I have corrected these things.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you. We have two more speakers on this, and Representative Kennemer, who's here for the next set of bills, has been very kind to say he's willing to listen to the next two speakers so that we can wrap up this bill. Thank you very much. So can I please call up Omar Camillo? Tina Harrow, sorry, I butchered that, and Martha McLennan.
Good Chair Kenny Geyers, members of the committee, my name's Omar Carriotti Najero. I'm the housing policy manager at Neighborhood Partnerships, and we convene the Oregon Housing Alliance, which is a coalition of nonprofit developers, local jurisdictions, and advocacy organizations. We have worked since 2004 to increase resources dedicated to affordable housing at the state level. We were the chief proponents of the document recording fee both in 2007 and in 2009. And I'm here today partly to share a bit of how the decisions were made, both around the collection and allocation of the document recording fee. But first, I want to say that the real issue here is that we do not have enough resources to meet the housing needs, and that this is true in our communities all across the state, as you have heard. Whatever happens with the document recording fee, the fundamental issue is that we don't have enough money at the state level to address those needs. Between 2007 and 2009, there were a lot of negotiations about how the document recording fee would be allocated. The Housing Alliance and our partners came up with the formula that Margaret described earlier. And there was a strong push at the time, both from Washington County and from Senator Betsy Johnson, to look very closely at how the housing resources would be allocated. We came up with the language that you see in lines 29 through 31 on the first page of the bill. And the first two lines on the second page, and those are the lines in statute that deal with the allocation. Then Housing and Community Services created a rulemaking process that allocates resources fairly over time, looking at the equitable distribution geographically, as well as focusing on how they're meeting priority housing needs. The department has a pretty complex system, as Margaret described, and I want to emphasize that part of this is really driven by federal housing resources and the restrictions and requirements that come with those. You have heard and seen from the department how this has played out over the past 5 years. And again, we feel that the issue here is that we don't have resources to meet the needs. You heard from members of the Housing Alliance at the informational hearing on March 11th about the bigger funding issues and the request that the Housing Alliance is supporting this session. We urge you to take action to create these housing opportunities and help to ensure that everyone in Oregon has a safe, affordable place to call home. And lastly, I want to say that the Housing Alliance welcomes the discussions these bills have provoked about timely reporting, as well as the prioritization and allocation of these resources. We're pleased with the attention that the legislature is bringing to the urgency of finding solutions, and we're committed to continuing to work to meet these needs. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Martha McLennan. I'm the executive director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're an affordable housing developer that operates statewide. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Oregon Opportunity Network, and that is a statewide trade association of other nonprofit organizations and housing authorities and community action agencies who all work on the issue of affordable housing. And I'm here today actually to testify in opposition to this bill. And you've had really very good primers in your previous speakers that tell you a lot about where this came from, what the dynamic is, what the problem is. I think I would say that this bill is an expression of frustration, primarily of two things. One is the lack of affordable resources to meet the needs that we see in a variety of communities around the state. And the second is a frustration in the lack of transparency and really understanding the allocation processes and the allocation results. One thing that I would say is that the best measure of the allocation of resources would not look at individual resources like the document recording fee in isolation. Different project types will have different blends of resources. So, for example, in an urban area or an area where you could build a larger project, say a 45 or 50 unit project, you would use low-income housing tax credits. That could provide as much as 70% of the equity that project might of its total cost, 70% of the total cost of that project. In a small community where you might be building 12 units, you couldn't use low-income housing tax credits, and it would need to get that kind of equity from another source, where the document recording fee might be the best appropriate source, or the home funds that come to the state for small rural communities. So in that example right there, the project that got the low-income housing tax credits may not need as much document recording fee. The one that didn't get the tax credits would need much more. So a disequilibrium that you would see in that kind of setting. Another example would be a project that's serving the workforce right at the 60th percentile, where that project might be able to leverage more private debt and use the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit more effectively. Whereas a special needs population serving folks who are very, very low income, which means that the property couldn't pay debt, might need more equity and might need more of the document recording fee. Again, a disequilibrium. I think in some of the material that the department has given you, they've tried to show you a little bit bigger picture of the total kinds of resources that they can allocate to processes. And when you see that, you see a better allocation across jurisdictions. The other thing I would say is that the document recording fee is all about real estate activity in a community, and it is generated where there is a high volume of that activity. What that means is it would respond, if it were allocated in the way that's proposed in this bill, is that it would respond to the issue of high growth areas. And high growth areas certainly have one kind of affordable housing need. But areas that are stagnating have a different kind of affordable housing need. And if you allocated it based on growth, you would miss what those communities need with this resource. So, again, those are kind of the things I would like you to keep in mind as you consider the bill. We also support the additional resources across the state, as many as we can find of whatever varieties and flavors we can come up with, and increased transparency and predictability from the department so that everybody knows kind of what accomplishments we're achieving across the state in terms of meeting the affordable housing needs. That I'd be glad to answer questions.
Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony and clarifying some of those things. I think you're missing a couple of points, though. I mean, there's allocative inefficiency right now with your current methodology. There's $20 million sitting in an account, so you have a problem with the current method. And then your criteria certainly is serving some counties, some communities well, but it's clearly not serving our community very well. So I think you need to look at your criteria, because just because we're high growth community doesn't mean that we don't have needs that are not being met by your current criteria.
So Representative Kitty Geyer and Representative Buehler, I just changed the pronoun a little bit.
Yeah.
I am not the allocator. I am competing for the resources, and I'm doing projects in Hermiston, in Hines, in Florence, in Clackamas County, in Hillsborough, all over the state. So I struggle with some of the issues of transparency and predictability in the same way that communities across the state would have that same experience. I do think that, it is a different problem in high growth areas than it is in stagnant areas, but there are affordable housing problems across the state, and the frustration is shared across the state. I think every jurisdiction, every county recognizes this as a struggle.
One more question, and then we're going to move on to lottery. This is a big issue. Yep.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming to testify. Can you please clarify what would be the alternative in your opinion? I mean, they're obviously the proponents of this bill are making excellent arguments, and so I'm trying to understand what would be the alternative. If this bill doesn't go through, then what really gets
solved? There are Representative Kenny Geyer and Taylor, there are a number of bills that are moving through the session, including the creation of a housing council, a state housing plan, and some increased reporting requirements. I think those would go a long way in terms of helping everybody understand exactly how the totality of the resources are being allocated across the state, and would be able to highlight from time to time or over periods of time whether we're meeting the allocation needs that should be met, whether the resources are really being distributed fairly or not. I think just looking at one resource in isolation creates an appearance of inequity that may not hold once you really start looking at all the resources in the totality. And having that information provided to project sponsors, to local governments, to the legislature, doing that regularly and routinely, I think, is going to help a lot.
Okay, final word to Rep. Bueller.
Just a point of clarification, though. I mean, you look at the totality, and one way to do that is per capita allocation of the funds. It's clearly inequitable. It ranges from, $843 allocated in Gilliam County to zero in Coos County. So,
yeah. Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Bueller. I recognize that. I think in terms of the resources generated by different counties, there are some counties who are generating $20,000 a year, less than $20,000 a year, $20,000 over 5 years. So that's not enough to support even one unit in those counties. I think It needs to be attended to. We need to have some creative strategies to do development in some of those smaller population centers and some of those counties that are not generating document recording fee. I just don't think that this bill will help us do that.
I don't disagree. Those statistics are not what's generated, it's what's awarded. And it ranges from 843 to zero.
I understand
that's what's
that.
Awarded. That's not equitable.
So these are really big issues where, equity can be per capita, can be per vacancy rate. There's a lot of different ways to cut that. Equity in terms of where the resources come from on that particular recording fee, there's a lot to mull over here. So let me move on from that. But this has been very stimulating, and I know this conversation will carry forward. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2959, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3316, 3317, 3318 for our representatives. Representative Kathleen Taylor, Representative Bill Kenemer are going to kick us off on this. We're going to hear a little bit about the bills you're introducing, so we're opening all of those right now. Then we're going to go to the informational hearing with Jack Roberts, and then we will go back to each of those bills one by one to give people an opportunity to testify on them. So, thank you.
Okay,
thank you for your patience.
Oh, I was here anyway. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer.
Well, that was mainly meant for him.
thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. I'm here, of course, with Representative Bill Kenemer, and I thank him for coming today to talk to you about lottery. I'm fortunate that Representative Kenemer was nice enough to work with me on different lottery issues over the year prior to me being elected, so I continue to thank him for that. So for the record, I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Representative, House District 41, encompassing Milwaukee, Oak Grove, and Southeast Portland. So thank you for taking the time to allow us to focus some attention on gambling addictions and the Oregon lottery. Representative Kenemer and I are here before you today to set the table, so to speak. There are others here to provide the quote-unquote meat, the data, and personal tales to highlight the dark side of our publicly supported gambling. But first, just a few facts. Over 80,000 Oregon adults have gambling problems. Most Oregonians in gambling treatment prefer Oregon lottery games. The Oregon Council on Problem Gambling estimates the economic cost associated with problem gambling to Oregonians is between $330 million and $600 million annually. That's between $660 million and $1.2 billion for the biennium, about the same amount of revenue that the lottery actually provides. I provided a fact sheet detailing additional demographic data. All of you should have that up there. Unlike alcohol and other substance abuse problems, there is a shame and embarrassment associated with being a pathological gambler. Gambling problems often come to light only after marriages dissolve, retirement savings are squandered, child welfare is endangered, or law enforcement becomes involved through embezzlement, identity theft, or burglary. 1 in 4 gamblers experience serious job-related problems. 1 in 10 attempt suicide. Oregon is one of only a handful of states that permit video lottery games, for example, video poker and line games. It is just these video terminal games that are most addictive. These are the games that cause the most harm. So that brings us to our dilemma. Oregon is heavily reliant on lottery revenue, but much of that revenue is generated from a small group of people and comes at a very high hidden cost to our state. The bills before you today probably won't change that, but they will help keep help to inform our decisions to more clearly define the trade-offs that we make. House Bill 3317 asks the Oregon Lottery to report to the legislature the distribution and concentration of video lottery game terminals in relation to the socioeconomic status of their neighborhoods. From the stories we hear, many people assume that much of the revenue generated from the lottery comes from lower-income, poorly educated Oregonians. But is that really true? We have no hard data. House Bill 3317 will give us the information we need to understand the demographics of our lottery players. What will we do with that data? Who knows? One example, treatment professionals could better target their prevention campaigns or focus additional education and outreach efforts in those areas. House Bill 3318 puts into statute the Responsible Gambling Code of Practice, already developed by the current Lottery Commission. Two important things here. The bill, as printed, talks about responsible gaming. That's the wrong word. It should be, it was just a mistake in LC, it should be responsible gambling. We've asked for the revision of the bill to reflect that change, but so far we have not received the amendment. The other important thing I want to put on the record is a sincere thank you to Jack Roberts and Elisa DeZono and the current Lottery Commission. They get it. They understand the dilemma surrounding problem gambling and have already developed a responsible gambling code of practice and are proactively working to promote responsible gambling. The bill will make sure that these positive steps don't get lost with future lottery administrations. That brings us to House Bill 3316, the No Casino Bill. Oregonians have spoken strongly that we do not want state-sponsored casinos. We want to allow gambling, but gambling must enhance a successful business, not to be the sole purpose. The definition of a casino remains undefined. One criterion currently in administrative rule used by the lottery to define a quote-unquote casino is that a retailer must earn 50% of its revenue from sales other than lottery. Many lottery retailers fail to meet that criterion, with some falling far behind that standard. Enforcement is lax. Data regarding sales is self-reported, so even the data that is collected is not thoroughly reviewed. House Bill 3316 would automatically deem the business a casino if over half the revenue of an establishment comes from the lottery and put some teeth into the enforcement procedure. This is an important discussion. When we drive down our major streets, we see many, many lottery retailers, some labeled delis. If you've ever been inside one, as I have, many of these establishments have a counter with a microwave, maybe a table with chairs, and a room with six lottery terminals, all occupied. No one is eating. No one is chatting and having fun like on the commercials. These are often filled with persistent gamblers, if you will, who regularly stop by on their way home from work or go late into the evening. It is the convenience of these gambling delis that has caused much of our gambling problems. These establishments are certainly not what the voters intended, yet our state is heavily dependent on this revenue. So what should we do? This is a discussion we need to have, and House Bill 3316 provides a vehicle for us to have this discussion. There is an amendment coming for House Bill 3318, and you already have the technical change to 3317. It is important that we begin to address these lottery issues, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. For the record, Bill Kenemer, State Representative, District 39. And it's very special to be before this committee. It brings back some memories because Representative Carolyn Tomei was such a wonderful mentor and someone who shared an enormous concern about this issue of the lottery and gambling and its impact on our state and on our people. And it's been delightful to work with this new representative and feel her passion and energy for this too, and to join forces. I guess let me just follow quickly through the bills. I think Representative Taylor did a wonderful job of itemizing a little bit of background in the bills. Let me just emphasize just a slightly different little my perspective a bit. You know, 3316 is the bill about trying to figure out what are lottery facilities and bars and places in delis and what are casinos. And I think that's an important distinction. One of the things that we do know about gambling is access makes a huge difference. And I think having a casino on every corner is, in my mind, not consistent with our responsibility to be in the best interests of the public. I also think probably outlawing them isn't in the best interests of the public, but finding that balance is a tricky thing. And I think originally, and I go back to when the lottery was first put into place, because I started in the Senate in 87, we had quite an emphasis on the importance of these facilities having food and other services and amenities available. So that they were not casinos. It was an addition. And then we came to having more separate rooms and on and on. But I think it's helpful to start figuring out what's a casino and what is a lottery facility. And I think those distinctions are important in terms of the welfare of our citizens. The second bill, 3317, and Representative Taylor said that, you know, we've sort of assumed that the poor are more impacted than others. And I've always called it a tax on the poor. But I think, because I think, you know, it's accessible, it's handy, it's, and if you're not careful, you get caught up in it. And I got to tell you, my wife and I have this favorite little place we like to go, and we sit in the bar on Friday nights, and we watch what I consider a minor atrocity, because people come in and they're well-intentioned. They start out with a few bucks, and they just keep going back to the ATM. And at some point, they've gone from having fun, I think, to showing signs of serious addiction, which is not in their best interest. I think part of it, though, is sometimes I'm not sure. I mean, if, you know, we're in the process here at the legislature of taxing the rich and trying to help the poor. And I think we need to look at this, and why not get some honest-to-goodness real data? Mm-hmm. Who is really around these facilities and who's attending them? So I love that bill as well. And then finally, I want to thank Director Roberts and his crew, and there's been a lot of persistence on this issue of a code of practices. We've tried for a long time, and it was resisted because the lottery is under the constitutional obligation to maximize profits consistent with the public good. And that's been interpreted on the more money side. And I think to come together with the Lottery Commission and the director and us with a code is a phenomenal achievement. Because, you know, I used to teach my patients, we always achieve our goals, including nothing. And if we're not careful, we don't know what we're trying to do. And if we're not careful, we get that chaotic result. And I think this helps us put some limits on there. What are we trying to achieve? We want an amenity. We want something for people to enjoy. We want to raise some substantial money for good causes. But by the same token, we want to minimize harm and minimize addictions. So I think that concludes my remarks, and I thank you so much for taking on this important topic, and I wish you well, and hopefully we can move through with these bills and see some continued improvement. It's been fun to watch how we've been massaging this into, I think, a more humane and better program.
Thank you, Representative. And I don't know if you're going to stay for the rest of the testimony, but I just want to take the opportunity, and I want to offer Representative Parrish the opportunity also to say how great it's been to work with you. We were all on a committee that yes. Chair Tomei had pulled together, yep. the three of us and Representative Tomei and Debbie in the audience staffed that, and yep. Representative Taylor was a volunteer helping to staff that as well. And so I do feel Representative Tomei's presence very much in the room, but it was one of the ways I got to know you in 2012, actually. Yes. And so a lot of good work has been done, and I'm yep. delighted to see it continue. Do you want to say a comment while he's still there?
Well, thank you. You know, I think that the work is really important. And one of the things just that we had a conversation about, and the lottery certainly gets asked to do a lot of things. I'm asking it to do something, too. But one of the things that we talked about, though, in that work is, you know, when we hear the phrase commiserate with the public good, which is what the lottery is prescribed to do, you know, one of the things that, if we want to be really intellectually honest about the lottery, we would actually say lottery, you know, net dollars that we have to spend, less societal cost equals true dollars that we have to spend, and then allocate those percentages that we want to spend and say that's what's left over. Because we've heard testimony years now into this where, you know, the societal cost is high. We fund public sponsored gambling treatment, and in 2010, I believe the report said 1,500 people self-reported $37 million in gambling losses who went into our state sponsored treatment. So I think we need to have a thoughtful dialogue about this. We had a bill 2012 or 13 that said, the bill that said, okay, well, we know there's some growth to the lottery. What if we capped that and said, this is all we're going to spend? And then what's, you know, how do we use that additional dollars better, or rainy day it, or, you know, do something different with it so that we don't encourage the additional growth? I mean, we do know it's a big piece of our total funds to allocate through the Ways and Means process. About near as I can tell, maybe Jack Roberts will be able to better describe it, but I think there's about 49% of lottery or so that's undedicated, that we have discretionary authority under some certain language to make those spending allocations, whether it's bonding for Connect Oregon or convention center hotels or whatever. But we have to look at that societal cost, and I think these bills continue to come back because we're not getting that done. And this is not clearly, with four of us here and Kathleen as a free slave labor for the 2 years she put in time and effort onto this, before, you know, getting paid her new legislative wage to be doing this work. But the fact is you have two Republicans, two Democrats who are holding hands on a lot of this, saying we have to do something a little bit differently and think about how we use these dollars and what do the dollars look like in the future, recognizing there's a lot of need in the state. But I've got women, I've got a gal in my district who, her husband, you know, blew through $250,000. My sister was a gambling addict, and she would steal your wallet to go and put it in the Oregon, you know, lottery system. We had a high-profile Westland employee who embezzled, and the state of Oregon did not write back a million-dollar check or whatever it was to the city of Westland. Like, I mean, we should put some triggers in that. So we'd like our money back. But so I think we have some real the lottery needs an updating for the 21st century and for 30-some years later, 84 to 2015, 31 years later. I think we need to put all of those things on the table and have the conversation.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos, did you have a question?
Yeah, I just had a comment. I really miss Representative Gilliam's voice on this, this committee. I think, you know, he clearly had concerns, and he would voice his concerns about lottery and our addiction, the state's addiction itself to lottery funds. So I just want to repeat that concern as well. And I'm sure, as a therapist, you know how critical that kind of concern is. You know, and it's interesting because I also share the same kind of concern about the legalization of marijuana. I mean, you know, we're going down these roads, and we must be sure that we're protecting our citizens as much as we can. So whatever these bills can do to help us do that, I mean, I think that's going to be great. So thank you.
Thank you for your comment, too. Yeah, I think we're addicted, and a lot of our citizens are addicted, and it's a very serious matter. And I think one of the blessings is I didn't get put on 91.
Thank you so much for continuing the work and kicking this off today.
Well, thank you for putting time and an emphasis on this. Bless you.
Thank you. Okay, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bills 33-16, 33-17, 33-18, and open an informational hearing with Jack Roberts, director of the Oregon State Lottery. Which bills? That's just 316. Other bills are almost.
Thank you. For the record, Jack Roberts, Oregon Lottery Director. And I know I was invited here for an informational session. I'm not sure exactly how you want to proceed on this. So if you can give me a little bit of guidance, whether you'd like me to talk specifically about the bills, or are there things just overall you'd like to have me cover before we do that?
I think if you could cover a little bit overall recent history in terms of how you're trying to address the issue of addictions in particular, what you've been doing. We hear there's been great cooperation. Would you like to give more guidance?
Thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer. Talking about the bills would be great. Obviously, background, I want to be sensitive to the fact of whoever, some people traveled here to testify, so I just wanted to remind everybody that some folks came to travel.
Yeah, let me just quickly say, one of the things to put it in context, because then I appreciate a lot of the comments that have already been made, but we have been, in recent years, the second largest revenue source for the state general fund, behind only personal income tax. We basically, this year, are on track for the 10th year in a row to sell $1 billion in lottery. That's both traditional and the video. The bulk of that is the video. Video lottery has been extremely profitable for the state since we adopted it in 1991, and in particular since we added the line games in 2005. Most of that was a period of sort of unbroken growth until we had the downturn in the economy in 2008. We also, in January 1, 2009, passed the indoor smoking ban, which here, as it has in other states, did have an impact on revenue, although I would suggest that it also had a positive impact on the way the lottery operates from the public good standpoint, in that it does, for those people who are smokers, cause a break in play, which is one of the things we try to do in dealing with responsible gambling, is give people a break. And so while that has had an adverse impact for us as a moneymaker, I think it has helped us be more responsible, as well as the other benefits of quality of life that it's had for all of us. So I've certainly believed that that's the situation we're in today. We're going to continue to operate in the current environment. We are starting to see some growth back, but from a little bit lower level. We've not regained the peak that we had in 2006 to 2008, and I don't expect us to. But we do want to see, and we're hoping to see, is some continued growth for the reason it was mentioned, because we are a critical revenue source for the state. Our revenue, as I think you all know, is basically dedicated constitutionally to education, economic development. A specific amount was dedicated by the voters through their own initiative. 15% goes to split evenly between parks and ocean beaches, and to salmon recovery and watershed restoration. And so that 15% is dedicated, and that you don't have control over. Whether you do basically control. And there's also, you have statutorily dedicated 1%, a minimum of 1%, for treatment of problem gambling. We as a lottery, and you, many of you here, helped us in the last session to restore our right to utilize that money to help with some of our advertising and helping advertise responsible gambling and the helpline to get help for people treatment. So there are things that we have done, but clearly I'm not going to pretend that this is the lottery as a whole is anything other than a very major revenue source for the state of Oregon. Having said that, we've always taken very seriously the maximizing revenue commensurate with the public good, and we've always believed that our responsibility to deal with the adverse impacts of lottery on many families, individuals, businesses is something that we take seriously. And that's why, after working with Representative Taylor when she was working with the Representative Tomei, we helped to develop some of the language that you now have in the bill talking about the responsible code of practice, responsible gambling code of practice. And I promised Representative Tomei, when that was killed in the Senate, that we would move ahead with it anyway, and we did. We were able to get our commission unanimously, which is, and they're very, very supportive of this, adopted that. So if I can jump to the bills, let me start initially with,
you know,
with
what,
that one.
Director Roberts, sure. I'm going to open the hearing, public hearing on all three, since you actually officially signed up to testify. And there are a few people who signed up for all three. And we'll just start with opening again House Bill 3317, 3316, 3318. And we'll have Robin give us a quick summary of the bills.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3316 makes explicit the definition of casinos for the purpose of prohibiting the operation of casinos as defined, requires Oregon State Lottery determine if lottery game retailers or applicants operate or intend to operate as casino as defined, directs lottery to establish process for reviewing lottery game retailers' operations. There is a pending dash one amendment to require to add requiring a report to the Legislative Assembly on or before October 1st of each even numbered year. House Bill 3317 directs Oregon State Lottery in coordination with Oregon Liquor Control Commission report to Legislative Assembly on or before October 1st of each even numbered year on the location and concentration of video lottery terminals. It also adds household income, education achievement, and occupational status to the definition of socioeconomic status. House Bill 3317 creates Oregon State Lottery Responsible Gaming Code of Practices Act as specified, directs Oregon State Lottery Commission complies with gaming code.
That was
3318. My apologies.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I think I'll take these in reverse order, if that's okay, starting with 3318, because that is one that basically is consistent with what we're already doing. There is language in here about changing the current mission of the lottery to add specifically informing user potential risks, and then also addressing, encouraging responsible use. Again, we're fine with that. So that's although I talked with the governor's office today, and officially I'm taking a neutral position on all these because the governor hasn't really weighed in yet. But I think this is one that we certainly don't see a problem with. 3317, which is about having the chart of where our lottery retailers are and the socioeconomic status. Again, that's fine, but I guess we're going to want some more direction in terms of how we define socioeconomic status and how we measure that and what we put into it. We have the capacity to do this simply enough if we can get that data pinned down, but we want to make sure that, since I think some people would view us as not necessarily a neutral party in deciding that, we don't want to be accused of choosing numbers that aren't representative. So whatever you can do to help us with that part of it, we'd be fine with that. The one that I would say has the greatest potential impact is House Bill 3316, which deals with trying to put in statute what has been called the casino prohibition rule and defining that and make it. We've not had that in statute before. Our casino prohibition rules are purely a creature of our rules. The idea of it sort of grew out of Ecumenical Ministries, although if you read Ecumenical Ministries, it really doesn't talk about the 50% standard and how you do it. It's a much broader standard. But from our standpoint, we have over the years modified and changed that. I think one time it was using a 60% rule, now it's using 50%. But about 10 years ago, we modified that so that rather than saying if you're over that, you're clearly a casino, we say that if you're under that, that's sort of a safe harbor and you're not a casino. If you are, then we work with them to try to get them to find ways to raise their other non-lottery revenue and do that, to basically bring people into compliance. And what I would tell you is that we have recently stepped up our efforts in that regard, but that in the past I don't think we've maybe done a very good job of that. Our commission is committed to going forward with it and trying to see what we can do to help make that happen. But the downside, the problem on the other side, is that these types of retailers who have places where they're not selling a lot of food or alcohol. In fact, I mean, we refer to them primarily as delis, although not all delis really fall into that category. But
Many of them sell more coffee than they do alcohol. They are often frequented predominantly by women. And one of the things that we've heard in talking to our players and checking is that there are a lot of folks who prefer those because they like to play the games and they don't want to hang around in bars and taverns. And so to a great extent, these have grown up here. This is not a model that existed elsewhere, although now it's being copied in other states. It grew up in response to demand. And part of our question is what is really serving the public good? And how do we do that in a responsible way? But we also have the additional problem, because I had our folks go back and look at it. We have today about 119 establishments, not all of them delis, that if we applied this rule strictly today, would be out of compliance. And they represent about $83 million in sales a year, which transfers into roughly $50 to $55 million in transfers to the state. So if we adopted this and we enforced it today, we could be facing a $100 million shortfall in revenue based on the projections that we've had before. Now, some have said, well, but if you shut those down, then they'll go play elsewhere. And, of course, some of them may go to the tribal casinos. They can go to the poker clubs in Portland and go to other places. But the other problem is if they go to other lottery retailers, we have now about 90 lottery retailers we identified that are within $50,000 of running afoul of that casino prohibition rule. And if these players went out and went there, they could tilt them over the top and we could end up closing more of them. So that's just an economic reality that you as a legislator have to deal with. And I certainly understand and appreciate the concerns about the public costs that the lottery creates, but you have to pass a budget based on the revenue that we provide and that we have. And so that's a public policy decision that you have to consider.
Representative Parrish?
Thank you. So if I go to Spirit Mountain, I can see a concert there. I can eat a full meal there. If I go to one of these delis, they're really not a deli at all. And in another universe, I used to teach OLCC classes, and the rule for having an alcohol license at the time, I don't know if we've changed it much, is that, five different types of food. So it can't just be like a turkey sandwich and a peanut butter sandwich, and that's two different things. It has to be five substantially different items. I don't know if we've changed that, but it's really clear you're not going there to get a good sandwich. You're going there to play lottery. Are there things within the construct of within your jurisdiction that you can put additional requirements on, whether it's meal service or something else that says, okay, we need to change the scope of your business, lottery, deli person, so that you're more, I'm there to, destination rather than just there to gamble? Because it seems like since you track with OLCC's requirements, and that's their rule for alcohol, and of course you can't have a lottery license without having a liquor license in this state. They go together, as I understand it, unless something's changed. It seems to me that we probably need to also consider what else is happening in the construct of that business, whether it's a percentage or not. I mean, something else needs to give, I think, rather than you just go there and you can get a bag of chips and a soda pop and we're a deli. I mean, that's right. So just even from a marketing and advertising perspective of saying this is the type of establishment we are, the activity that's happening inside doesn't reflect that.
Thinking a couple of things about that. Number one, yes, they are licensees, but it's not all the Class A dispenser. They also have Class B and the other categories. So the OLCC does the enforcement from their rule standpoint, and we do the enforcement from our rules. And to best of my knowledge, the OLCC has not had problems with these places from their license, although we do work pretty closely with them, and I imagine we would know about it if they did. Yes, the answer is, do we have authority? We have a lot of authority in terms of what we can require them to do, because unlike the OLCC, which grants a license, we have a contract. Mm-hmm. And the contract actually provides that either party can terminate on 14 days' notice. So although, as any government agency, we can't be discriminatory, we can't be arbitrary, but we can work with them. And that's frankly, a lot of what we try to do is to find other activities that they can engage in that are not just lottery. Part of the problem is not all of them are moneymakers. If you say, why don't you at least have some other games you can play? The idea is not to have all of it be gambling. how much revenue would that generate? Well, from our standpoint, it's having the opportunity to be to do other things, have TV screens, so it's a sports facility. We have places that have pool tables. Mm-hmm. We have places that have a lot of other amenities, and that's why we don't want to look strictly at the dollar cents figure. But the real test from what Ecumenical Ministry said is people going here, do they say, oh, this is just a place to gamble, or do they say there's more to it than that? So I think we can do more. We think we can do more within our rules than we can by trying to pass a statute that has a rigid standard like this. But it is something that we're trying to concentrate on to get a different reputation for a lot of these places. By the same token, I think we have to keep in mind that when we're saying, okay, so the balance here is off, you're not selling enough food and beverages, it gets us in the strange situation that we're saying that the problem is it isn't that people are gambling too much, it's that Oregonians aren't eating and drinking enough, and that's not really consistent with most of the other public policy issues. By the same token, what we're saying is, well, we just think we're raising too much money for the lottery. That's, again, that's something for you guys to consider, and I think the point has been made and it's been suggested before. Let's limit how much money we're going to spend. And that's your policy call. We're asked to maximize the revenue, but if you want to set a different standard, we want to meet certain standards of that. I will just say, wearing my private citizen hat, and having lived here for a long time, Oregon state government seems to be much better at limiting its revenue than at limiting its costs, because a lot of things that the government does tend to be the things that the cost drivers are out of our control and they keep going up. So I would just caution you, if the goal is to try to limit lottery, it would be nice. In fact, if you wanted to say the lottery's history has in many ways been driven since Measure 5 passed, where the move to video lottery and the change of the Constitution to allow it to be used for education, it's the only major replacement revenue that we've had for funding education since Measure 5. And, of course, we've had Measure 47 and 50 since then. So those are the public policy issues you're going to have to wrestle with, and I think it's appropriate to discuss that. But from our standpoint, our charge today is to maximize the revenue consistent with the public good, and we're trying to balance those.
So let's get – thank you so much for your testimony. I know we've got a lot of other people signed up. Thank you, Mr. Roberts. Can I please call up Nicole Corbin, Jeff Murata, and David Ellsberg? Yep. And all three bills are open right now. So start right in, because we have only half an hour left.
A lot of people who want to talk.
Yeah.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, members of the committee, I'm Nicole Corbin. I'm the Addiction Services Manager with the Oregon Health Authority Health Division. And I would like to provide some perspective and information about problem gambling, as all of these bills, as we've discussed, are related to the fact that problem gambling exists, and it's not necessarily well-known and well-understood. Problem gambling has been recognized as an issue for literally centuries. As long as we've had gambling, there are people who struggle with an addiction to it. Disordered gambling is an addiction. It is not a behavior problem. It's not a moral failing. It's not a choice. Disordered gambling was previously known as pathological gambling and had been categorized as an impulse control disorder not otherwise specified, which perhaps doesn't have the power and ring to it of understanding what an addiction is. In 2014, an updated version of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, known as the DSM-5, was published. The DSM is the professional manual for all behavioral health issues, and these updates do not happen frequently. Changes are made only when there is sufficient research and practice data to warrant a reclassification. So I think it's significant, speaks to our understanding about problem gambling and gambling addiction, that disordered gambling is now classified in the same chapter devoted to substance-related and addictive disorders. The new manual reflects decades of research findings showing that gambling disorder is similar to substance-related disorders as far as clinical expression, brain origin, comorbidity, treatment. So what that means in plain English is that someone who has a gambling addiction, who has disordered gambling, presents very much like someone who's addicted to alcohol or addicted to other drugs. They find that they need to gamble more and more frequently with more and more money in order to have the same rush. They find that they try to stop gambling, but they're unable to. They find that they are preoccupied with gambling. They think about it all the time. They find that perhaps they do things that they never would do if they weren't in the grip of an addiction. They commit crimes. They lie. They steal. Unfortunately, there certainly is a high risk and rate of suicide with people who struggle with a gambling addiction. Problem gambling includes, as I said, all those behavior patterns that are very similar to other addictions. Even though no substance is ingested, we know that the problem gambler has the same effect, and that there are brain studies and research that shows a very similar physiological pattern in someone who struggles with gambling addiction as with an addiction to alcohol or an addiction to heroin or an addiction to cocaine. Oregon has more ways to gamble legally than almost any other state. Now, Jeff can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think only Nevada is ahead of us at this point. So someone who is struggling with a gambling problem or is at risk for problem gambling has access to video lottery terminals, scratch tickets, keno, bingo, card rooms, casinos, Powerball tickets, raffles, and more. I challenge anyone who has not thought about this before to look around as you drive home and just see how many opportunities there are to gamble just on a perfectly mundane street in Oregon. Problem gambling is a public health concern. Greater accessibility of gambling opportunities is shown to increase gambling among adults and youth. It increases money spent on gambling, and it increases the number of problem gamblers. Gambling opportunities continue to grow as our population grows as well. And because of this growth and accessibility, it's essential to mitigate the risks and consequences associated with problem gambling through access to prevention, to treatment services, to responsible gambling guidelines, to good policies and practices, and to good data reporting and collecting. It's estimated that about 81,000 Oregonians, 2.7%, meet the criteria for gambling disorder. And to put that in perspective, that prevalence rate is roughly the same as people who have addictions to substances other than alcohol. So if you think about how often you might have heard a news story or read an autobiography or a work of fiction about someone struggling with a heroin problem or a methamphetamine problem, approximately that same amount of time you would be thinking of someone who's struggling with a gambling addiction, but we don't hear about that. You don't hear those stories. You don't see those movies. And so gambling addiction remains largely a hidden addiction that people are not aware of. For each disordered gambler, it's also important to realize that there are many others who are affected, their spouse, their children, their friends, their parents, their employers. And those other affected people make a tremendous cost on Oregon in the form of embezzlement, as Representative Parrish mentioned, in the form of loss of productivity at work, in the form of other health-related issues that go along with that problem gambling, in the form of child welfare costs or corrections costs. Knowing that we've got a lot of other people who want to speak, I will try and move forward. But I will say that in reference to House Bill 3316, AMH takes a neutral position. If this were passed, it is possible that this would result in decreased budget allocations to the Oregon Health Authority for problem gambling services, secondary to the fact that it would have potentially a decrease to lottery revenue overall. Theoretically, it also could potentially result in a decrease in problem gambling incidents, as fewer Oregonians might be in close proximity to a video lottery retailer. Proximity to slot machines is related to problem gambling prevalence rates. As many other VLTs would still remain, it's unclear what impact the reduction VLT retailers would have. AMH also takes a neutral position on House Bill 3317. House Bill 3317, which requires data collection, would provide useful information to the Oregon Health Authority's problem gambling services for the purpose of strategic planning and programming. Information that would be gathered should this bill pass could identify high-risk areas, and once we were aware of high-risk areas, we could target those areas with problem gambling treatment, with problem gambling prevention, with education messaging to reduce or mitigate the risk resulting from gambling. with regard to House Bill 3318, responsible gambling practices are tremendously important to the Oregon Health Authority. The partnership that we currently have with the Oregon Lottery is very positive and plays a vital role in supporting the Oregon Health Authority's problem gambling services. If the lottery were someday in the future to take a less active, responsible gambling stance, that would certainly negatively impact our services on a number of fronts. To most successfully reduce gambling-related harm, this issue needs a comprehensive solution that talks about policy, that talks about partnership with the health authority, that talks about partnership with the lottery. And so we definitely want, we see the Oregon Lottery as an integral part of the solution. Without the Oregon Lottery's active involvement, our efforts to reduce gambling-related harm would be hampered.
Okay. Thank you, Nicole. Jeff?
Yes. Madam Chair, Kenny Guire, members of the committee, I am Jeff Morata. I'm testifying to you today as a private citizen. I am also a problem gambling expert, and I run a company, Problem Gambling Solutions, that works with various agencies on responsible gambling and problem gambling issues. I'll speak to you today and also reverse order, just follow Director Roberts' lead. Before I do that, I also want to express my gratitude to this committee, and especially the members who, Representative Taylor, outstanding introduction of the issues during your opening comments, and the members of the Problem Gambling Committee that Representative Guire and Representative Parrish and Kenmer were all a part of. So thank you very much. House Bill 3318, the Oregon Lottery Responsible Gambling Code of Practices, very much in support of this bill. This bill lines up well with what the Oregon Lottery has most recently accomplished in developing the Responsible Gambling Code of Practice. What I would certainly urge to occur is the amendments that have been put forward progress, and so that this bill most closely align with the Oregon Lottery's code of practice, responsible gambling code of practice. And the reason why this bill is really so critical, I've been involved with the Oregon Lottery in various ways since 2000. I've seen five different lottery directors over that time. The lottery, reflecting the lottery's director's position and political pressures at the time, and other factors, have really responded very differently and put different amounts of attention into this issue over the years and over the directors. And and it's been an ebb and flow. There's been times where there has been some nice effort being put forward, some great advances, I felt, and then some major kind of falling back, if you will, and from a responsible gambling perspective. And this legislation, I think, is really critical to assuring that the Oregon State Lottery will maintain its public obligation to be a responsible operator of state lottery. So, again, critical bill. Very much appreciate appreciate it and support it. The next one, House Bill 17, 3317, looking at the neighborhoods. Research tells us that neighborhood disadvantage significantly predicts frequent gambling and problem gambling. Furthermore, individual low social economic status, when you combine that with neighborhood disadvantagement, problem gambling is at its highest level. So we know that different communities, different neighborhoods are more impacted by problem gambling than others. And the lottery has certainly, and I think is very willing to share where their retailers are located at. The problem is nobody's really doing the work of putting the two together. And as you heard from Ms. Corbin, that this could be very useful information for the Oregon Health Authority, and I think it could be very useful information to the lottery as well in carrying out their responsible gambling code of practice. If they know that there are certain areas that are going to be more impacted by a Oregon Lottery VLT retailer, certainly ones that have a higher density of retailers already, I think there would be good reason to not award a new contract. So that's good information for them as well. The
The last bill, the 33, let's see.
16.
16, thank you, with the casino rule. I was just looking at the Constitution today, and I thought it was interesting. The Oregon Constitution states, the Legislative Assembly shall have no power to authorize and shall prohibit casinos from operation in the state of Oregon. What I found interesting is that it precisely says the Legislative Assembly has the shall prohibit. So it's not only shall not authorize, but prohibit casinos. And what you have before us today is this ambiguity of, well, do we have casinos operating? And what's very clear is that we need to clarify what is and what is not a casino. And I think passage of HB 3316 is needed to provide public confidence that the Oregon constitutional ban on casinos is not lampooned through state agency-supported businesses that generate most of their income through video lottery sales and primarily function as a place where gambling games are played, which is the most common definition of a casino. And one of the things I provided you, just some data, this is the second sheet of the written testimony, is the top 25 Oregon lottery retailers. And just for comparison purposes and kicks, I wanted to see, well, what does a sandwich restaurant, a typical sandwich restaurant, sell? What are their sales annually? And so I looked at Subway as an index, and Subway restaurant on average brings in about $481,000 in sales per year. And when you look at, you know, Dottie's and Richard's Deli and some of these other so-called delis, what you'll see is their lottery sales alone will more at times triples that number. So it's pretty clear these are not operating as sandwich restaurants. So with that, I want to thank you, and I'd be happy to address any questions you have.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, for listening to me and the members of the committee. And it sounds like a lot of my testimony has been given already, so I'll try to shorten it.
Can you say your name for the
record? David Ellsburn. I'm sorry. David Ellsburn. I'm president of Voices of Problem Gambling Recovery. I don't know why they elected me president, but you're stuck with me for now. For House Bill 3318, I have a little editorial here, and don't panic. I'm not going to read the whole thing, just the first line or two. Imagine the public outrage if state governments began to rely heavily on liquor sales to pay for vital programs, raising revenue by encouraging people to drink more and even advertising new alcoholic concoctions on billboards. Yet the public is strangely quiet when it comes to the aggressive promotion of and fiscal reliance on gambling, which, like drinking, may be harmless for most, but is a severe problem for others. So this editorial was written by somebody you probably know, Theodore Kulongoski, and another gentleman, Peter Bragdon, who was a deputy attorney general at the time. It was written almost 20 years ago, and things have not changed a lot since then, up until now. And I give Jack Roberts a lot of credit for his responsible code of gambling that he's helped to push through, and I think that's great. But I agree with Jeff that is Jack in the room still?
Yeah.
He might retire tomorrow. I was just going to ask him that. But, you know, we need to have continuity with this. We need to have direction from the legislature that it's a good thing that he did, and we need to continue it. So I hope you support this bill. 3317, our organization always is in favor of more transparency. 3316, like Jeff mentioned, the Constitution prohibits casinos. One big sticking point is, though, is that it doesn't define what a casino is. And the lottery had their 50% rule, and that's how they defined a casino for a long time. Now they're kind of shifting away from that, and they want to say, well, if you put a couple of pool tables in the corner, it's obviously not a casino. Representative Parrish gave the example of Spirit Mountain. And Spirit Mountain has a couple of restaurants, a deli, a video game room for the kids. They have a hotel. They have an entertainment venue. They have a disco. They have all kinds of stuff, but no one would say they're not a casino. And so I think we know what a casino is when we see it. And as Director Roberts said, you know, a lot of these smaller marginal businesses are really mini casinos because if you go in there, and I challenge you to do this, go in there and buy a sandwich sometime to one of these delis that's in Lancaster Mall. It's only like 3 or 4 miles from here. And there may be 20 or 25 of these places all along within a half mile of Lancaster Mall or Lancaster Drive. And sit down there, buy a sandwich, and when you're finished with the sandwich, you look at the plate and you think, well, how much money did they make on selling me the sandwich? Maybe they even lost money on it. And then as you're eating the sandwich, you're watching the gamblers, and you see them putting bills into the machine, going back and forth to the ATM, and you think, well, how much money are they making on gambling? And I think it's very clear that these are businesses that make their money on gamblers, and often it's on the problem gambler and the pathological gambler. So I don't think it's a good idea to have a mini casino or a slot machine parlor on every single corner. Why am I worried about it? It's because I have a gambler in my family, and when they drive down Lancaster, they know where every single one of these locations are, because that's the nature of a gambler. And they're trying to be in recovery now, but every time they drive by these places, it's a trigger, and they're in danger of relapsing again. So I hope you support this bill also. Thank you.
Thank you. Unless there are burning questions, I want to try to get to the other people. And I'm also hoping, colleagues, you can stay till 5:15. We have 9 people to go, and if each of you can do it in 2 or 3 minutes, we'll be out of here by 5:15. Thank you. So I'm going to close the hearings on 3316 and 3317 and keep open the public hearing on 3318 and call up Tim Murphy and Sharon Williams. And just talk fast.
You got it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Murphy. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Bridgeway Recovery Services, which is a gambling treatment program. And I first want to say it warmed my heart to hear Carolyn Tomei being invoked by members of the committee and by Representative Ken Meyer. I had the pleasure to work with her over the last several years. And one of my comments to my friend Jack Roberts, who I was sitting next to during the testimony, was that after Representative Taylor got finished with her presentation and Representative Paris spoke, it's sort of nice that I don't have to do the testifying as much as I used to, because for years we came in and made the case about the perils and problems and the devastation of problem gambling, and now it's becoming woven into the fabric of the discussion, and I respect you and I thank you for your presentation. Primarily around represent, and I was planning to talk on all three bills if necessary, but really with the 3318 is the conversation around the responsible gaming, responsible gambling language that is being used, and really respect Director Roberts. There's been a lot of nice things said about Director Roberts. He's done a really remarkable job of changing the conversation between the Oregon State Lottery and those of us that work with problem gambling. The change in language, the continuity that will come from supporting this bill, I was saying to Director Roberts, long after he and I are gone, they'll be codified into the language, if this bill passes, the appropriate way to have continue the discussions and have that lined out. So I urge all of you to strongly support House Bill 3318. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Kenny Geyer.
Yes, that's right.
And the committee members. My name is Sharon Williams, and I'm a recovering gambler. I thank you for allowing me to speak today. Representative Taylor's explanation of this bill was very thorough, and I believe it described me. I identified with the actions and behavior and the consequences of the problem gambler. When I started gambling, I thought I didn't even really know I was going gambling. I was going to play bingo with my sister-in-law. But it appeared innocent to me. It was inexpensive, and it was legal. So, you know, I didn't have any problems with any of that. What happened, though, is that, well, first of all, I loved gambling from the first time I ever went. So, you know, I'm not going to go through my whole history, but everything became more. I was spending more money. I was spending more time with gambling and less time with my family and my friends and my job and anybody else who knew me at all. You know, I was playing more often. I was lying, and that just increased over the time I spent gambling as well. You know, I had a lot of family destruction. My husband, he actually, we got separated about a year before I quit gambling. I wanted him to stay and promised him I would quit gambling, and he left anyway, so I said, okay. I'll go gamble for another year. Anyway, but also, you know, a lot of financial issues, no trust, very little time with my family, serious financial, I already said that, devastation. And I had health and both mental and physical health issues at the end of my gambling. Some of that caused by depression, but a lot of it was from sitting around in places and not doing anything and not taking care of myself. So I stole from my employer. I was also an embezzler. I lost my job and I lost a pension. I had pending legal charges. I was seriously depressed. My next step, because I didn't know what else to do, was I attempted suicide. So I pretty much hit on all those things, and I identify with it. Some recovery literature that I read often states that the gambling behavior can lead to prison, insanity, or death. And I always have identified with that ever since I first heard it, and because that was me. I was right there on all of them, and it was a miracle that I didn't die. And today I'm grateful that I didn't die, but it's not an easy move from knowing that I'm that person, and I did that to my family. So I support House Bill 3316. I think we do need the clarification to prevent this is the wrong note.
33, well, we're on 3318.
3318, okay, yep. Sorry. We do need the clarification to, you know, so that the code of practice continues and doesn't get changed or dropped off or anything. So I'm just asking that you, you know, please support this bill.
Okay.
And thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim. You can go. And Sharon, if you can stay, I'm going to close the public hearing on 3316. Open it on 3318.
Close it on 3318.
Is that the one? Okay. So close it on 3318. Open it on 3316. And you can stay up there to testify on that. And then can I also please have, let's see, Westwood and Ruth Ritzgal.
I got a call at 5, so I got to go.
And Sharon, why don't you go ahead and give your comments on that bill.
Okay. So, again, thank you to all of you. I'm still Sharon Williams. I'm a recovering gambler. The clarification about the mini casinos is very important to me. I heard the statements they were talking about the food, and I have direct knowledge of that. You know that they either don't have any, or I mean, I know one person who ordered a sandwich when they were gambling once, and they didn't have any bread. Mm-hmm. and they had no cooking vessels. But something happened last night. I was attending a meeting, and there was a new person in the meeting from Bend, and he moved over to Forest Grove for work. And he was talking about he had ridden the bus, and he was really surprised at how many and he rode from Forest Grove to Hillsboro. So he had, you know, just through those three towns, he had witnessed several video poker and lottery retailers, and he was very surprised at that. I think they probably have, you know, their fair share in the Bend area, but maybe he didn't just see them, you know, in these small towns where you see, I mean, it's very noticeable when they're all right there. So that to me was just another sign that, you know, if someone's moving here from another part of the country or even the state, sometimes that they're pretty amazed by how much there really is. And I think it's too much, and I think it should be, you know, clarified as to what it is and monitored. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chase, go next.
Hi, my name is Ruth Riskadal, Madam Chairperson and the committee. I'm here to speak as a citizen, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about my road to how I was able to go from gambling addiction and what it took for me to get back on the road for recovery. I started my addiction in 2001 and consistently gambled for 5 to 6 years. And during that time, I had started out with calling the 1-800 number, coming back from a casino, and started GA. And then I went to, that wasn't enough for me because I realized I needed more. Then I went to the GEAR program, which is actually a counseling that you can do by phone and by mail. And then I went from there. That wasn't enough for me. Couldn't handle it. So I went from there to outpatient treatment for problem gambling. And then that still wasn't enough for me. So I tried to commit suicide, and then I realized I needed residential treatment. It wasn't until I got to residential treatment that it started getting better for me. Then I went from residential to outpatient, and then I did outpatient treatment for 2 years. And then after that, I went into a support counseling group that I consistently go to today with my GAs to maintain my recovery and work with the sponsor. And this took me like 4 years to complete all this. And that was a long road for me. And that was a long, hard road for my family. And what I'm here testify about is I'd like to give you a view of what it was like to go to the delis and what it was like to go to Dottie's. Now, I've spent hours at Dottie's. I would sit and play for like 7 to 8 hours. During that time, I would probably see maybe 3 to 4 people come in to get cigarettes, and maybe one person come in to get a sandwich. This happened quite a lot. I did not see clientele that would support a sandwich shop. Another thing is they would give us Coke free, coffee free, just like Nevada casinos. We didn't even have to pay for it because we were feeding the machines. We also had what they called a whiteboard. So when we come in and we can't get a machine, we put our name on the whiteboard. And then we wait to get a machine. But we wait to get a machine. We don't eat during that time. We're problem gamblers. All we want is that machine. one of the things I had to do with living in a city that every block that was close to where I lived had a deli shop or video poker was I had to put myself on house arrest. I got to the point where I was afraid to walk down the street or the block. So to me, this is a very important bill, and I advocate for it as a citizen.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Congratulations on your ongoing recovery, too, both of you.
Yes, please. Hi. Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Wes Wood, and I'm the Director of Public Relations Services for Voice of Problem Gambling Recovery. I'm going to say thank you to Sharon. Thank you to Ruth. This is what we're dealing with. 80,000 times every morning. It's hard to believe. And if you extrapolate that out to the family members and the businesses and the employees and the employers that are touched by this, any little bit of money that is lost by lost retailers due to enforcement of a real plan is nothing. There's no comparison. There's been a lot of great things said today, and I appreciate all of it, including Jack Roberts. We have worked really closely with those folks, and there are really good things happening right now. So I'm just going to read you my closing, frankly. So, okay, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and our work is to advocate and educate and promote recovery for those who are affected by problem gambling. As the numbers continue to grow, we are seeing families, 80,000 Oregonians, dealing directly with the devastation of the compulsive gambling, plus their families, plus their careers. We are well aware of the charge of the Oregon Lottery and its mission when we ask for it by the citizens and the government. This bill, 3316, is about many elements. It's about transparency. It's about responsibility. And it's about the partnership between the public and the state government and the Oregon Lottery. It's about being proactive at all levels. It's about acknowledging that regardless of the changes within the Oregon Lottery, its commission, its director, its leadership, the public can know the level of expectation will include the intended accountability. It is also about being smarter about how we choose to do business in Oregon. Mistakes made earlier in early times do not have to be what defines this period for us. It includes maximizing revenues for the state of Oregon. If the unintended consequences are too much at any level, we must be prepared to seek a solution, navigate the resolution, and implement the healthier path on behalf of all Oregonians. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, can we
Before you leave,
I
just want to thank you for your courage for coming, both Ruth and Sharon. I do have a question that's sort of an aside. The group you go to, is it a 7 or a 12-step type thing, or is it something different?
I do GA meetings. I work with a sponsor, and I also do a counseling support group that is with the same people that I did treatment with.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oops. Okay, can we please call up Martin Slappikas and Charles Kufner. Anyone else? Okay. And then we'll have two more after you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Kenny Geyer and committee members. My name is Martin Slappikas. I'm the vice chair of a neighborhood association called High Noon. The formal name is the Hayden Island Neighborhood Network. It's a Portland neighborhood association that's been recognized. We support House Bill 3316, amending the Oregon Revised Statute 461-300. And we do so because factors such as financial responsibility, accessibility of place of business or activity to the public, and security of the premises, number of existing video lottery retailers, all of this resonates with our community. For the past several years, residents and businesses of the Hayden Island community have experienced the effects of policy and contracting decisions made by the Oregon State Lottery in such a manner that has affected community livability and has become a public safety issue. We have also experienced and witnessed the city's effort in the amount of local community manpower and funding it takes to attempt to correct Oregon State Lottery decisions gone awry. Video lottery retailers operating as mini casinos have been one of our main concerns, particularly when they are concentrated in one location, such as what you might have heard of Lottery Row. For years, the Oregon State Lottery has ignored the income analysis and casino determination authority that are memorialized in the Oregon Constitution and current Oregon administrative rules. In our opinion, it is the main reason for many of the problems associated with video lottery. The following is why we believe that to be accurate and why we support House Bill 3316 amending the statute. Now, that being said, I do not believe, frankly, that we would be here if the Oregon Lottery had followed their own Oregon administrative rules. It's as simple as all that. And I'm not going to go through every one of these. I got seven pages here that you might like to read before you go to bed or something. But it starts, what's a viable business? They go out and they recruit businesses that are supposed to be viable. They're supposed to be able to sustain themselves without relying on lottery income. But yet, on December 3rd, 2014, at an Oregon State Lottery hearing regarding a proposed change in compensation, small mom-and-pop establishments surprised me when they offered, they said they purchased their businesses based on lottery revenue. They cranked that into the figures. That doesn't sound like a viable business on their own without selling video lottery. Now, our concerns, High Noon's concerns, began with the applicant not being required to show little, if any, financial viability of their business. Any person may request an application from the lottery, any person. The director is supposed to conduct a review of the established total income, which is supposed to equal an annual lottery compensation, the establishment's annual lottery, non-lottery sales. This continues even as the video retailer pursues the business that originally qualified it as operating continuously for at least 90 days. 90 days is all you are required to be in a lottery operating business, and I don't think any business can operate 90 days and show a profit and declare themselves to be viable. In the case of the Oregon State Lottery, video retailers have been assigned a burden of proof, and they only required to self-report a gross sales report. That prevents the sales report prevents the OSL from enforcing the casino prohibition oversight responsibilities, and ensure the possibility of non-compliance with the Constitution and the OAR mentions above. Now it goes on. They go into a director's casino determination. The question is, has that ever been done? I doubt if it ever really has. We believe that OSL's weak internal operating procedure provide little incentive for video lottery retailers to provide accurate revenue reports. Video retailers can expect their self-reporting of non-lottery revenue to be accepted with little or no scrutiny. The lack of oversight results in a perverse incentive for video retailers to avoid scrutiny by the OSL, and therefore to defy accurate, timely agency or public oversight. So long as these self-reports satisfy the director, there's no need to ask for more reliable figures for non-lottery revenue information. So how do they determine that? Remember, they don't have to be a viable business. So how do they determine that, that they are not a casino? Well, there's an income analysis. Now, that's being addressed in 3316. But it's also been memorialized in the Oregon administrative rule for years. But it's never been enforced. At least I don't believe it has. The other thing is they have in the regs the way to do it. The OIR specifies that business records be made available for calculation of total income. When was the last time that the OSL audited a video retailer's business reports? I doubt it. Some video retailers appear to publicly scoff at Oregon State Lottery rules. Mr. Dan Fisher, memorialized in a letter to House Speaker Kena Kotek, he states he acknowledges his reliance on gambling profits. He's one of the major players in this whole business. The casino operation is publicly acknowledged by experts. Mr. Bob Whalen was reported, many gambling and liquor industry clients and an economist at Portland Echo Northwest is quoted, if it wasn't for the lottery, there would be no Dotteries. No Dotteries. The Tribune reported that for 2 years, Mr. Whalen has inspected the books of many lottery retailers. Effectively, they lose money on food and drink, and they make it up on lottery. That's public. That's public, and we're living with it. It's a paper tiger. What business is viable? If this rule is implemented, theoretically, the businesses that are impacted by this will either comply or they won't comply. If they don't comply, theoretically, they should go back to being a viable business. No harm. But that is really not the case. There's a lot of reasons why we support this. I won't bother to read them. You can, as I say, fall asleep with them.
Yeah.
But there is one last thing I'd like to say, if I can get to it. Mr. Roberts, at one of the meetings of December 9th of last year, said that the OSL, Oregon State Lottery, has no responsibility for its businesses. Their only mission is to maximize revenue for the state, but yet they're responsible for contracting viable businesses to begin with. They have no responsibility for the businesses that they contracted. The Oregon State Lottery casts a blind eye in upholding the no-casino provision of Oregon's Constitution. OSL's inability to enforce the no-casino provision results in subversion of policy that the citizens of Oregon deemed important when they enacted the new constitutional amendments. In our opinion, passing this bill, 3316, will encourage financially viable businesses to contract with the OSL. It will provide an administrative certainty for all citizens of Oregon. We believe it's imperative that it be passed.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee, my name is Charles Kuffner. I'm a retired lawyer and judge from New York State. I've been living on Hayden Island for 15 years, and I've been fighting Casino Row for the last 8 years. I have to ask one question of the Lottery Commission. If the common good is to be upheld, my training as a lawyer always told me that the constitution of the particular state expresses the common good for the members of the state. If they don't review, even though they did it in 1997 of Dotteries and found that they're out of compliance, if they can do it in 1997, why take alternatives to the 50% rule, not apply the Constitution, which says no casinos? That's why 3316 must be passed. You do make a definition of it. And to hear Commissioner, I guess, is it a commissioner or the chairman of the chairman of the OLC say that they're projecting sales of $1 billion? Does that mean that 50% of that is non-lottery income? I would tend to doubt it, because I think the most telling thing you heard in the prior testimony is, what does the average Subway franchise generate in gross sales? I did a little offhand survey of McDonald's, and the average McDonald's in the United States, which sells only food and beverages, roughly $2 million, whereas Dottie's 24 at Hayden Island's Lottery Row reported $3 million+ in non-lottery revenue? I'm sorry, I'm a skeptic. I think the big dilemma here that you're facing, and I think the legislature is facing, is that if the legislature created the Oregon Lottery Commission, then the state legislature has to insist that they practice good business management. There is no book on business management that authorizes, condones, or even recommends in predominantly cash businesses that you let them self-report. April 1st. What happens on April 15? You sign your income tax forms and you swear under the penalties of perjury that the information included therein is true. Take a look at the form that Mr. Slepikas has given you as an attachment to his statement, his formal testimony. Look what the Oregon Lottery Commission compels the licensees to say with respect to their income. And I think last but not least, I have to say that as much as I don't want to cast aspersions on anybody, until such time as the lottery industry separates itself from the Oregon Lottery Commission, you're never going to get, at least in my view, a person who's going to say, I have confidence in that organization. And I have to relate you back to the appointment of the current chairperson. She was a partner in Milanesh. Milanesh represents Dottie's. How am I to get past the appearance of impropriety in that? How am I ever going to have confidence as a citizen in this state that what is being done at the Oregon Lottery Commission is in the best interest of the people of the state? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've got two people, Jim Stirrup and Bill Perry. Last two. Thank you for bearing with us.
While they're coming, can I just make a comment?
Yes.
You know, one of the things that's interesting to me about all of this, and particularly when you hear people share their losses, is the IRS has a provision that says that, you know, you're supposed to report gambling winnings, and then you can report gambling losses up until that point. So if you go to a bingo hall in the state of Oregon, or you go to Spirit Mountain and you win $1,200 on a hand of, you know, blackjack, they fill you out a 1099 form that I can then also say, here's my losses, that it, how much did I have to spend to earn that $1,200? We do not do that. So there is no way for people who've suffered gambling losses out of the state of Oregon to show that in any way, shape, or form on their tax return, and just something for us to consider as part of a bigger scope of conversation. And how do you help people who have addictions recuperate any portion of their loss? This is one of the only, well, that and the poker rooms in Portland that are totally operating not legally either. But those are the only places where you don't get that 1099 type form. There's no documentation of winnings and losses, and so there's also a whole that 80,000 people who are suffering losses have no mechanism to access the losses on their tax return that other gambling establishments offer. So.
Thank you.
Question.
Chair Kenny Geyer, committee members, concerned Oregon citizens. For the record, my name is Jim Stirrup. I'm a fourth-generation Oregonian. I've worked in the gambling business in Nevada and New Jersey for 20 years. However, I have no connections whatsoever with anybody involved in gambling in Oregon. I might also add my wife works for a legislator, but I don't express his views. I've never even talked to him about it. So, House Bill 3316 addresses the biggest challenge that has ever faced the Oregon Lottery in its history, period. Not even close. It has tremendous revenue and integrity implications. I was going to give you a snapshot of what we're talking about when we talk about a casino, but I think it's been pretty well covered during the course of the testimony. And there are 200 to 300 of these deli casinos, illegal casinos, lottery delis, whatever you want to call them out there. And it's been pretty well discussed how much revenue they generate, which is, of course, the revenue side of the story. The integrity side of the story is they have flown in the face of the Oregon Constitution. They have taken business away, siphoned it off from legitimate bars and restaurants, and the proliferation of these establishments has most definitely contributed to problem gambling. I don't believe there's any question about that. I'll take Wes Wood's advice and get right on to the conclusion here very shortly. I think all the pieces are in place right now to address this challenge. We have an Oregon legislature that's more and more informed and more engaged in pursuing it. We have a very strong leadership element at the Oregon Lottery and Oregon Lottery Commission, and an Oregon Lottery team that is really great. So I think a lot of the pieces are in place to, again, tackle this challenge. So just let me conclude by saying I think passage of House Bill 3316 would send a very clear message to the Oregon Lottery and also to all Oregonians that we are behind your efforts to confirm that the integrity of Oregon gambling is not for sale.
Thank you.
Thank you very kindly for the chance to testify, and thank you for all the great things you do for our state.
Thank you, Jim.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, here to talk about 3316. It's hard not to agree with everything that's been said in the room today, except for I do want to shed a little kind of short history lesson if I can. And the industry in the lottery years ago, and it was the late 90s, I can't remember the year, we were the ones that basically passed the bill to set aside 1% of lottery revenues to go to addiction treatment, something done by the legislature and the lottery. In 2003, there was a bill passed that added a sixth machine. I was working at the Restaurant Association at the time. I opposed that bill. I still think it was not a very good idea. In 2005, we sponsored and supported a bill that basically did away with sports action. If you remember, state used to have sports action gaming. That was our bill that did away with it. It also replaced, because at that point in time, line games had just come on, so we basically put that money in the sports account. So that's what funds the scholarships for women's athletics and some different scholarships for need grants. And then as Representative Parrish acknowledged in the work group that I was at some of the meetings, I brought up the cap bill, one that says you should cap spending, because at some point, you know, the spending is what's driving a lot of this. And the reason I included this handout, if you look at the one, there's always been one rate in Oregon, a commission rate, and it's always gone down, and every year it seems to go down more and more. They didn't change it this time. The blue line was in response to the sixth machine. Basically, that's what I basically said when I was opposing the bill back in 2003, is you're going to put a lot of retailers out of compliance with the 50% rule. The legislature acknowledged that. They basically told the lottery that they had to change their rule, and then they implemented that rate for higher end retailers. If you see the dotted line, basically what it says is if you do over 675,000 in sales, option B is going to be a better option for you. So that came out of the legislature passing the sixth machine bill. The other thing that I want to point out is if you flip it over, you look at the total retailers in the third or fourth column, you go down to 2010, retailers have been declining in the state of Oregon since 2010. Like I said, good, bad, or indifferent, doesn't really matter. It's just kind of a fact of life. If you go over to the OLCC licensees, these are the three types of licensees that are eligible for video lottery, they're increasing. So you're getting more establishments but fewer retailers. So there isn't really a growth. You go down to the next one, it says video lottery is growing at about an average of 1.5%. That's going to be up this year for some different reasons we can chat about if you'd like. But the GDP growth, the other forms of amusement, and the food and lodging are all growing over 5%. So, I mean, as of right now, video lottery is not keeping pace with inflation. Like I said, you could say that's good, bad, or indifferent. It doesn't matter. The legislature during that same time period has been projecting 4% growth. So in essence, the lottery, you could argue, is underperforming what you're asking them to do. I mean, good, bad, or indifferent, they are. They're not producing the revenue you're asking them to produce. Your retailers are shrinking. And the other thing, the continued frustration, is this legislative body, not you guys, because most of you are new, every year steals from the sports action account. They steal from the addiction treatment account. Mm-hmm. And we saw a slide up here today in the former presentation right in front of us. There's $9.1 million in bonding on lottery that's going to be coming out of this session. So you are bonding lottery at 25%, where you only bond income taxes at 5%. So once again, you're sending a message that this is a long-term revenue source for you. And at some point in time, you can beat up on the lottery, you can beat up on the retailers, you can do all that, but this has been a product
of this process. It's not been driven by the lottery. I would even argue that the lottery, when you look at the retailer base and the growth rate, is not meeting the projections that this body is setting out for them. So I guess if I was going to make an ask in the short term, is we need to stop stealing from the addiction treatment account. I wish we would spend as much time on that as we would some of these different bills. I wish we would not steal from the sports account and the scholarship account. At some point in time, we need to start addressing some of these issues. And remember, the business was built off the project of the legislature, and I think the frustration with the retailers is all of a sudden you want to come in and pull the rug out from under them. They didn't ask for the sixth machine. It's just it was something that was given to them, and businesses are built off of it. And, you know, at some point in time, we need to stop spending the money if we're really going to send a message. And if you want to harm the lottery or the retailers, but you still want to go, the budget this time is built on a 4% projection growth. And so to say you're going to meet that, but you still want to pass bills like this, I just don't think it's fair. I mean, let's just be honest, it's not fair. The legislature created the problem. The legislature needs to solve their issue first before they start asking the lottery or us to solve theirs. I just think it's the only fair way to deal with it.
Okay. Well, we'll end today with another challenge. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on 3316 and adjourn the meeting. Adjourn the meeting.